From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, a psychologist who worked for 40 years in California's prison system writes a book about the psychology and treatment of criminals. Plus, musician Brent Bourgeois on liberal politics and evangelical Christianity. And Sacramento rock poster artist Paul Imagine. He's featured in a new film about America's rock poster scene. But first, what do Iranians in Sacramento think about what's going on in Iran? The disputed election, the huge protests, now the government crackdown. To try and find out, Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler recently went to a restaurant popular with Iranians in Sacramento. He joins us with some of what he heard. Ben, welcome back to Insight.
Morning, Jeffrey.
Where did you go to meet Iranians?
Went to Famous Kebab. It's a fairly popular Persian restaurant just right by the Sacramento city limits in the unincorporated area, the county being, you'd call it Arden Arcade. It's Fulton and Hurley.
And when did you go?
Sunday evening on Father's Day. So we should, just mention right up front, the tape is a day or two old, and we know things are changing really quickly in Iran right now. But at the same time, a lot of the questions that I asked are general ones that go beyond the simple ups and downs of the daily news cycle.
Well, give us an example of someone you spoke to.
All right. Well, the waiter, or one of the waiters at Famous Kebab, was named Soli, and I asked him who he voted for and why.
So far, anyone I've seen around, they are supporting Mousavi. Basically, what I think, people, they are not supporting Mousavi or Ahmadinejad, but between bad and worse, people choose the bad. You know what am I saying? So they rather, to just choose the bad than worse. Young people here, they're supporting Mousavi a lot more than Ahmadinejad. I've never seen, any young people around me to say, I support Ahmadinejad. I've never seen, honestly. So far. But I've seen a lot of young people so far, they just saying, that was not right. We wish, Mousavi become a president, and probably if he become a president, he has, more flexibility, and he's more open-minded than Ahmadinejad. And it's going to be better for Iran.
And I should just say, again, his name is Soli. He declined to give his last name because he has family in Iran, and he would fear for their safety if he spoke out too much.
So that was a waiter at Famous Kebab. You were out on Sunday evening looking for Iranians and Iranian Americans to find out what they make of what's going on in their home country. Who else did you speak with?
Well, one of the people eating there was Mohabbat Nejad. Mohabbat Nejad lives in Sacramento. He runs a restaurant in Lodi. He came to the U.S. Came to the U.S. about 20 years ago, but left Iran about 30 years ago. And when I asked him who he supported, he had a somewhat different answer.
In Iran, is not election, was selection, because Ahmadinejad is same Mousavi, same Ahmadinejad. Because both of them is Islamic Republic of Iran and fanatic people, and we don't like it. Nobody is. It's Ahmadinejad is sugar baby for my supreme leader.
Ayatollah Ali Khamenei.
Khamenei, yeah. I like it, the change in my country, and one governor for, I want for my country, one government, Democrat government.
Sounds like some more support for Mousavi, but a general skepticism about the whole thing.
Yeah, in fact, and I should say that I kind of went out of my way trying to find at least one Ahmadinejad supporter, and I simply could not. I asked everyone who I spoke with, do you know anyone who supports Ahmadinejad? I asked a professor of government at Sacramento State, who's the director of the Iranian and Middle Eastern Studies Center. I asked an imam of a local Islamic center that's got a large Iranian community, and no one was able to say, yes, I know of someone who supported Ahmadinejad. So in my story and today, we're playing clips that generally represent a certain viewpoint from this highly educated Iranian-American community here. And if there is support for President Ahmadinejad, I haven't been able to find it.
Did the professor or the imam or anyone else tell you why there's no discernible support or little discernible support for Ahmadinejad in Sacramento's Iranian community?
Well, it put it this way. after, you know, this is going to be a little bit flippant, but after the 2004 election when President Bush won, we didn't hear any Republicans talking about moving to Canada. So if you're happy with the form of government that you have, you're a lot less likely to leave the country. And I think that's the case here. I spoke with a few people who left around the time of the revolution or shortly thereafter, and that's the reason they gave for leaving, that they didn't like what the country had become. And I think the imam I spoke with and also the professor said, you know, the people who have, the Iranians who have come to the U.S., they've come because they I guess would rather live here right now.
I'm talking with Capital Public Radio news reporter Ben Adler, who spoke recently with Iranians and Iranian Americans in Sacramento about what they think about what's going on in Iran. One of the people you spoke with was the owner of this restaurant that you went to, the famous kebab. Who is he?
His name is Sam Babai, and he actually had a really fascinating story that I guess he wouldn't find it very fascinating, but I mentioned it in my report this morning, which is at capradio.org. There's the cheap plug. And he mentioned that he had been keeping track of, you know, obviously watching on TV what was going on, and he was watching on Friday the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, say basically if there are any more protests, any violence that results are going to be the protesters' fault. He said it made him sick, and his heart was beating so fast that he had to go to the emergency room. But in general, as regards the Ayatollah, he's very frustrated with not only President Ahmadinejad, but really the system of government that puts the Islamic Republic, the way the system of government's run. I'm not an expert, but the clerics are more in charge than the president. And Mr. Babai says he thinks that should change.
I would like to be changed to the moderate way, because if we electing somebody as a president by the direct vote, we don't need other, you know, sort of the government in the top of him.
Religion is a very important part of Iranian government right now. Do you believe that that should be separated, that as we say here in the U.S., that church and state should be separate?
Exactly.
Why?
Because when you go by the ideology, then whatever you do according to that, you have to go through the religion things. But when they are separated, then you have more freedom to think, to thought, and do whatever is necessary and right for the country.
That's Sam Babai, who's the owner of the famous kebab restaurant in the Sacramento area. He's from Iran. One of the most prominent stories that's come out of Iran in the last day or so is this video that's circulating on YouTube of a young woman who's a protester bleeding to death. Had that video been seen by people or by you when you were talking with these people on Sunday night?
Not by me yet, but certainly by one or more of the people I spoke with. I think Mr. Babai mentioned that specifically and said you can't help but be a human being when you see that, and you can't help but pay attention to that. And I think that's having a big effect here.
Another part of the story is how the rest of the world is responding to what's going on in Iran, the protests, the government crackdown. Did any of the people you spoke with talk about the U.S. response, President Obama's response?
I asked them all about that, and there was a general consensus that at least at first what the president has been saying, the president's decision to take a lower profile has been a good decision. There's a little bit of a question mark or a difference among them whether he should continue that path or speak up a little bit more now that there's violence in the streets. But here's a representative answer from a gentleman named Nasser. He's a civil engineer, and he also requested that we not use his last name.
At the beginning, the comment that Obama made, I agree with that. First, he said, well, yeah, this is the people's, it's up to people what they want to do, whatever. And he didn't want to get too involved with this. And I said, maybe it's not bad, because he shouldn't get involved, and then they're going to say, okay, these people that they're on the street, they are supported by U.S. or Obama. And also he says that he still want to have some relationship and negotiation with them. Maybe that's why he doesn't want to make some very harsh comments about, you know. But now is everything is changing. So many people are getting killed in that country. So he has to change his opinion or his message that he's sending. He has to send a message to Iranian people to let them know that he's supporting the people.
Ben, any observations about how the people you spoke with regarded you, looking for their thoughts, their opinions, their feelings about what's going on in Iran, and about their own feelings of safety, the family safety, if they talk to the media?
There were certainly some people who did not want to speak with me. I think that was actually the majority. Mr. Babayev very nicely went around the restaurant asking his customers if they'd be willing to talk. And only a couple of customers said yes, one of whom was a friend of Mr. Babayev. They were eating dinner together. And then I talked with Mr. Babayev himself and the waiter. And also there were a couple times where the family came over or a wife came over with a husband, and usually the husband, only the husband would talk, and no one else chose to. The other thing I would point out is that I guess it kind of seems obvious, but they're saying that this community is dialed in. They are keeping an extraordinarily close watch on what's going on. I'm sure Iranian Americans are throughout the country and perhaps the world too. But they're the ones who did talk to me really wanted to talk, and they wanted to give me a history lesson. They wanted to explain the peaceful nature of the Iranian people, which in their mind does not match the government. And they really wanted that to be clear. And one person said, you know, Ahmadinejad made Iranian Americans embarrassed to be Iranian Americans, because everyone thought, oh, you're Iranian, you're like Ahmadinejad, and how do we prove we're not? So I think there's a lot of complex feelings going on right now, but I think there's a lot of hope, and yet mixed with a little bit of nervousness and fear about what could happen next.
Ben Adler, Capital Public Radio news reporter, who spoke recently with Iranians and Iranian Americans in Sacramento. Ben, thanks as ever.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a psychologist who worked for 40 years in California's prison system writes a book about the psychology and treatment of criminals. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We welcome your suggestions. Send them to insight@capradio.org. Coming up on Talk of the Nation, how should President Obama talk about Iran? Plus, the challenges of coping with long-term unemployment, and a conversation with Phil Jackson of the LA Lakers, who's now won more titles than any other NBA coach. That's Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. How to Create and Maintain an Alien is the provocative title of a new book about the psychology and treatment of criminals. The author is a retired psychologist who worked for 40 years in California's prison system. Arthur Maddox lives in Auburn. Arthur Maddox, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
What does the word alien mean in the context of your book?
It means a person who is not used to the culture in which they are living at the present time.
And when we're talking about criminals, do they become aliens for your purposes when they arrive in prison, or do they arrive as an alien?
They arrive as an alien. For most of them, they have been in and out of juvenile and prison situations since early childhood.
So they arrive as aliens, but did you find many inmates becoming further alienated, if that's the correct word to use, as they stayed in prison?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The longer they spend in prison, the more they become adjusted to the prison culture and alienated from this culture out here that we live in.
Did you become a psychologist in order to work in prisons?
No. Absolutely not. That was the furthest thing from my goals.
So how did it come about?
Well, it came about quite accidentally. when I had to do a 9-month internship at San Francisco State University. And they called me in and told me that they had this position that was difficult for them to fill. But they thought I could handle it because I had been my first 2 years of college as night charge of a violent ward in a mental hospital. So they told me, it's at San Quentin Prison.
Wow.
Yes, that was my reaction.
So what was your job at San Quentin?
Well, my job was to work with the treatment staff there and doing evaluations and also doing therapy, both individual and group therapy.
At that time, what was the goal of treatment and therapy in a place like San Quentin?
Well, the primary goal was to hopefully help some of them when they got parole to stay out of prison, and the others just to help them adjust to prison.
Because a good number of them, I guess, were going to stay there for the rest of their lives.
Yes, I had some of those.
How much did the prison system care about those individuals, that they would become better adjusted?
Only that they become better adjusted to prison if they weren't already. Saw very few of those that were lifers. But I did get to go up and with the chief psychiatrist and evaluate some death row inmates.
My guest is Arthur Maddox. He's a retired psychologist who lives in Auburn. He worked for many years in California's prison system, and he's written a book inspired by those experiences titled How to Create and Maintain an Alien, An Insider's Look at Criminals and Their Culture. What did you see when you worked with those death row inmates? Is there something different about them psychologically?
Yes, most of them had a very resigned attitude, and of course, they were isolated in individual cells, and it was interesting that a few of them even joked back and forth with the guard.
Yeah.
So they had made their own adjustment, too.
Generally speaking, and I realize that you have written a book about the matter, but we'll try and talk about it concisely. Generally speaking, what is it that makes a person a criminal, psychologically?
Psychologically? Well, it occurs in their background, the childhood to adulthood. I dealt with a lot of them who were so brutalized as children that I think the average person out here couldn't imagine that anyone would treat children that way. And of course, this made them angry and alienated from authority figures, particularly. And it was just a growing process. So they're not born criminals. They're raised criminals.
People are raised criminals, not born.
Right.
Some people think that talking about a quote-unquote bad childhood or an abusive childhood, more to the point, is just an excuse. And it really doesn't matter. You know, we all had problems in our childhood, so it goes. Mm-hmm. So this way of thinking goes. And that doesn't matter. You still punish them.
Yes, except the fact that we've known from ancient history that punishment does not work in deterring criminal behavior. The fact that that most people don't think that it will has created serious problems in increasing the population of prisons.
When you were a psychologist in prisons, how did the prisoners treat you as the psychologist who was coming along to evaluate them and treat them?
With lots of suspicion. I was just another representative of the authority initially. But as I started listening to them and letting them tell me things they wanted to tell me, they begin to develop a trust. And that is the essential part of working with anybody, including inmates.
Doubtless you worked with, over the years, with inmates who were released back into society and who made a success of it. Were you able to keep tabs on these people, how they were doing, even have contact with them?
Yes, I got letters from a lot of inmates at the prison, and they would tell me the difficulties they had adjusting. Some even returned that had made the promise to themselves that they were never coming back to prison. But they told me they were so frightened out there, and the culture was so foreign to them that they just couldn't stay out there. They had nightmares, literally.
My guest is psychologist Arthur Maddox, author of How to Create and Maintain an Alien. What about the criminals who you weren't able to reach, who couldn't be treated, who didn't get better? Why would they not get better?
Well, a lot of them were already so alienated that they, it was, I called it a salvage operation. There were those, it's like I did the analogy to damaged cars, car wrecks. Some were slightly damaged and could be repaired and released back on the road shortly. Others took a lot more effort and time, and some were so badly damaged that it was impossible to salvage.
Were you ever in danger?
Yes. I cite a couple of incidents in there.
Were you attacked?
No. Fortunately, I had that background working with violent patients in the state hospital, and I learned to remain calm in such situations. That violence is often contagious, and if you get all upset, you can precipitate a violent act. So I would remain calm. In fact, I got nicknamed at one time Dr. Mad because I remained calm and calmed down a very violent individual that was acting out.
Well, I don't doubt for one second what you're saying about the contagion of violence, but still, if you're in a confined space with a proven dangerous person who's yelling at you and maybe about to jump at you, it's got to be hard to stay calm.
It's not easy, but it's essential. And I one incident, it turned out very, very well, but I have to admit, I was... my inside feelings, I was very careful not to exhibit outside.
What would you like the average person in California, who obviously helps fund California's prison system, who periodically is asked to vote on measures relating to criminal justice in prisons, what would you like the average person to know about California prisons and its inmates?
I would like to emphasize a point here. When I initially was working with the prison system, the heads of the department, like the head of the prison, California prison system, started out at the bottom as a correctional officer and went through civil service exams and interviews and according to their performance, moved up in ranks to the top. So the director had started at the bottom and moved up, and he knew the operation from the ground up. Unfortunately, later, it became a political appointee. They quit. They dumped the civil service system, and the governor that came in politically appointed the heads of departments.
The epilogue of your book, How to Create and Maintain an Alien, is very critical of the current state of California's prisons and criminal justice system. You call it all, quote, a gigantic mess. You list the many problems for society that stem from that, and you end by rhetorically asking your readers, how much are you willing to pay to just lock offenders up and throw away the key? Is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Well, if you want to really continue paying high taxes to house inmates, you want to lock them up and throw away the key. But if you do not want to pay these exorbitant costs for housing an inmate, you will encourage rehabilitation and research on how to do better rehabilitation programs. That was something else that did. I was appointed head of the clinical research for the Department of Corrections by the director. And the point was to try to evaluate what was most effective and what was not, and try to improve the results of the programs and not just set them up and forget them.
Arthur Maddox, a retired psychologist who lives in Auburn. He worked for many years in California's prison system, and he's written a book inspired by those experiences titled How to Create and Maintain an Alien, an Insider's Look at Criminals and Their Culture. Arthur Maddox, thank you so much for joining us today.
I thank you. You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, musician Brent Bourgeois on liberal politics and evangelical Christianity. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Check us out on Facebook. Our page is Insight on Capital Public Radio. And you can be a fan. It's like being a friend. If I ask you to think about the politics of evangelical Christianity, chances are conservative politics come to mind. But a new book makes the case that liberal-minded folks can feel at home in the evangelical movement. The author is musician Brent Bourgeois, best known for his 80s band Bourgeois Tag and his later separate career in the Christian music business. Bourgeois' book is called Left Behind, Jesus in the Age of the American Empire. He joins us. Brent Bourgeois, welcome back to Insight.
It's nice to be here.
On your website, you wrote, quote, many of the people who come to the site to hear my music are generally horrified by the essays and books I write. Why do some of your fans not like your opinions?
Because they have a preconceived notion of what I should be, based on the music that they've heard and the lyrics. A lot of those, most of those people are evangelical Christians who come to find my music, and they have assumptions about that we all should be one particular, believe one particular thing. And,
did you ever share those political views earlier in your life?
No.
So... Yeah.
No. I mean, I was always there. You know, there's a chicken and egg thing. I'm liberal because I'm Christian, or I'm Christian because I'm liberal. I mean, you know, you could argue that forever.
What kind of home were you raised in, both religiously and politically?
I was raised in a Catholic home, in a conservative home.
Conservative politically.
I have four siblings that run the gamut, though. My father is a libertarian all the way, far right kind of. My oldest brother is a Rush Limbaugh ditto head. My next brother is kind of a atheist. He's a quantum physicist. So he's a libertarian. My older sister is a Democrat, an artist. My younger sister's a leftist, you know, an absolute Baha'i leftist.
I have to wonder about Thanksgiving.
Yeah. No. Well, you know, especially if there's a few glasses of wine involved, it can get a little crazy at the Bourgeois family Thanksgiving table.
My guest is Brent Bourgeois, author of the book Left Behind, Jesus in the Age of the American Empire. What gave you the idea to write this book?
It was a chance for me to get my own thoughts together. I lived in Nashville for 8 years, as you mentioned, doing the being in the Christian music industry, and it always boggled my mind that there were 99.5% of the people that I met in that world were right-wing Christian. You know, they were Christians and right-wing. And I never felt that way. And you know, the further I went along, it you know, we all claim to follow the same guy, you know, but how could we be so far apart? Is it me? You know, why did I feel this way? And all those people felt that way. And so I really just kind of one day struggled. I just decided I was going to put my thoughts down and do some research, kind of find out why I felt the way I did.
When we think about conservative politics and evangelical Christianity, it's really social issues, I guess, that we focus on, because that's what seems to get talked about the most. Where do you stand on all the various quote-unquote life issues, abortion, capital punishment, war, so on?
I'm glad I'm not running for office. well, I consider myself pro-life. But that's a deep subject. I mean, I think a lot of evangelical Christians start with abortion and end with abortion. And, you know, that's their pro-life stance. And they might be for the death penalty. They could be for any war we happen to go into. They, for me, the issue of pro-life means I am against abortion. I am against the death penalty. I am against all war except for in the most dire straits. I'm not a pacifist, but... I certainly was against the Iraq War. I'm for the environment. I believe that the environmental issues are issues of pro-life issues. I'm for gun control. I'm against violence in video games and in movies. I think these are all issues of pro-life, but none of those get talked about in the evangelical community, basically, except for abortion.
And it's tough, I'm guessing, to unify all those positions, at least in some cases, because a lot of liberals tend to side with some of those positions and conservatives with others, and not the twain meeting.
Well, I don't believe that you have to be 100% one way or the other. I mean, you know, I consider myself liberal, but there are things in that community that I don't agree with. But, you know, if you're forced to place yourself somewhere, I mean, I think everyone could find issues with wherever they are in their political spectrum. They're going to have problems with something. And if they don't, they're pretty much lying to themselves.
My guest is Brent Bourgeois. His book is Left Behind: Jesus in the Age of the American Empire. Also on your website, you've posted some essays, and one I really enjoyed is titled The Christian Bookstore. And you went into Christian bookstores to do research, I guess, for your book Left Behind. And you were shocked by the political nature of a lot of the books, including the leadership genius of George W. Bush. And you went to the counter and complained about the books.
It should have been in the fantasy section, but... well, you know, that was... They had a book in there, defeating the Democrats, why, you know...
Crushing
the Democrats. Yeah. You know, it just boggled my mind. It's right next to the Bibles. You know, it doesn't really do any good to complain about this stuff, other than because the guys behind the counter, they don't even know what they're selling. I mean, they're just people. You know, and the guy looks at it and goes, resell this. You know, it's more above them that. You know, people would answer that with, well, you know, what do you want, left-wing stuff in there? No, I don't want any of that stuff in there. It should all go to borders where it belongs, you know, because we're a free country and we should have books called Crushing the Democrats, Crushing the Republicans, whatever you want. But it shouldn't be in a Christian bookstore. That was my problem with that.
If I remember correctly from reading opinion polls, it seems like the majority of evangelical Christians tend to vote Republican. Why do you think that is?
It's easy. I mean, first, abortion, because they feel like, and you know, that they can't be anything else but a Republican and vote, and be pro-life. And that's kind of a myth, because there are Democrats that are pro-life and there are Republicans that are pro-choice. You know, it's often given a lot of credence by the pastors in the church, who, you know, will claim that they don't preach politics from the pulpit, but they do. And preachers have a lot of authority in their community, because because that's just the nature of evangelical Christianity. You know, you have 1,500 people sitting on a Sunday morning, and if the pastor starts, senior pastor in his authoritative voice starts railing on Muslims, 1,500 people will go out of that church, you know, with a anti-Muslim feeling. So these social issues, I thought Jesus was about social justice, was these issues of caring for the poor, caring for the needy. But every 4 years we get, it's more about homosexuals than it is about anything else, and which is something Jesus never brought up, and I don't think he would have cared much one way or the other.
You lead worship in a church on Sunday mornings.
Yes.
Do you bring up politics, hint at politics when you're in front of the congregation?
Well, the church that I lead worship in is St. Mark's United Methodist, which is called a reconciling congregation, which means that it welcomes gays, lesbians, GLBT, yes, into their church. And there's quite a contingent of people in this church who have finally found a home where they've been rejected by many other Christian churches. And all they want to do is worship the same God that I'm worshiping, but they've been thrown out of many other churches. They're simply not welcomed. I don't have to preach politics at that church, neither does the pastor, because it's all around us. And I'm not particularly in favor of it in that case either. There was a thing that they did one day during a Sunday mass that I didn't like, and it was coming from the left. I just don't think that's really the place for it. But, it's a place for me to do what I do on Sunday mornings.
It says on your website, I'm no longer in the music business. What are your plans now?
I'm an author. I want to be an author when I grow up. And I'm writing. I've written a couple of novels, historical novels. I'm in the middle of another one right now. I just feel like it's a more expansive way to be creative. And writing songs, you're kind of stuck in a 3-minute pop format, and I think I have ideas that kind of go beyond the 3-minute pop format, like this one, you know.
Yeah. Well, having said that, I hope you'll forgive me if we just play a clip of a song of yours that I found on your website. I didn't know you'd worked with Robert Palmer, the late singer. We'll listen to a bit of the song, I'm Down With You. And that's Robert Palmer singing. How did that happen? How did that come about?
In Bourgeois Tag, we went on tour with Robert Palmer for a long time. He requested us as his opening act. He's a real music lover, and got to know him very well. And he invited me to come. He lived in Switzerland, and he invited me to come there for 2 weeks to write with him. And so we wrote a couple of things for him. And we wrote that song that I ended up doing on my record. And then when he was in California, when I was doing the record, he agreed to come in and sing a duet with me. So
that's great. I love the song.
No, it's fun. That's the great side of doing what I used to do. You know.
Brent Bourgeois, former musician, author of the book Left Behind, Jesus and the Age of the American Empire. Brent, thanks so much for joining us again.
It's been my pleasure.
Public Radio. Coming up, a new film about great rock poster artists, including Sacramento's own Paul Imagine. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. If you missed a previous Insight, it's okay. Check our archives at capradio.org/insight. Sacramento's best-known rock music poster artist, Paul Imagine, is featured in a new documentary about America's rock poster scene. The film is called American Artifact. It's about the artists who make those sometimes colorful, inventive, and even scandalous posters for concerts and albums. American Artifact plays tonight in Sacramento at the Crest, just a few days after its world premiere in San Francisco. The producer-director, Merle Becker, and Paul Imagine join us. Paul, welcome back. Merle, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Paul, how did you become a rock poster artist? Was it a plan you'd had for a long time, or did it just sort of happen?
It just sort of happened. I always loved music. I was into the heavy metal when I was in high school, and that's kind of out of reach for local people, you know? I mean, you got huge concerts and huge stadiums and all that. And then after high school, I got involved in the punk rock scene, and that was also DIY, and everyone was doing everything themselves. So it just kind of made it easy to get in and start working with local bands.
Paul Imagine is a Sacramento rock poster artist. He's featured in the film American Artifact. I haven't seen the whole film, but I've seen clips on the website. And one thing I love is when you hold up your finger to show this big callus on it.
Yeah.
Why? Can I see the callus again? Whoa, that's a callus. And why do you have it?
That's my drawing finger. It's calloused and a pen is imprinted into my finger because I draw so much. So
it's proof of what you do.
Yes.
Merle, what gave you the idea to make a film about rock poster artists?
I was in a bookstore, and I came across this huge coffee table book called The Art of Modern Rock, and it's this big book of contemporary rock posters, and I had no idea that posters were still even being done. I thought the 60s happened, and, you know, there's posters from that era, and it kind of opened my eyes to everything that's going on today, and I was struck because a lot of the bands in this book were these obscure bands that I listened to and that I didn't really, you know, I wasn't aware that they were commissioning art for their stuff. So that was kind of the spark. And
at that time, weren't you working in another visual part of the music business, MTV?
I was.
What were you doing there?
I was an editor on a show called Total Request Live, which is a live
heard
show.
Of that.
Yeah. So, but I've always been really into music imagery and music videos, and I'm an obsessive music fan. So,
how did you profile a whole bunch of artists in the movie? How did you come across Paul Imagine?
Paul was mentioned to me by Dennis King, who's one of the co-authors for The Art of Modern Rock. Well, I was familiar with his work, and I knew he was in this area. And now Dennis kind of suggested him, and I put him on the roster. And he turned out to be one of the best interviews.
We're talking about the documentary film American Artifact. It's about America's rock poster scene. It plays tonight in Sacramento at the Crest Theater. Merle Becker is the producer-director. Paul Imagine is a local artist who's featured in the film. Paul, you sort of half-jokingly in the film, say that when you're starting out with a poster, you often start with a skull. Why is that?
Pretty much a skull will fit for every band in the punk rock scene. If you're out of ideas, you can always head for a skull, and it's pretty much universal. So,
you're wearing a T-shirt of my favorite piece by you, and at least I think it is. I don't have my glasses on. But in any case, it's this poster of this hideous skeleton sitting in a toilet reading a newspaper about the Bush-Gore election.
That's not this shirt. But that was
one of his many.
It's a similar skeleton, though.
Yeah, that was one of the posters I did when Bush and Gore, no one really knew who was going to win. And it's kind of just we're screwed either way kind of poster.
It's a shocking.
So you might as well stay in your bathroom on the toilet.
Yeah.
Don't
it's
leave.
A shocking image. Why did you decide to make this hideous, deformed skeleton sitting in a toilet be the central image for that?
You know, sometimes strange things fall out of my head and I can't really explain it.
Yeah. Merle, how did rock poster art get started?
With the birth of the dance concert in San Francisco, there was two main promoters, Bill Graham and Chet Helms, who started commissioning rock posters. And they would, you know, rock really wasn't on the radio at that time. It was still sort of this new thing. So you had to advertise it somehow to get people to the shows. So they would do these posters and they'd go around and hang them up. And legend has it, Bill had he would ride around on his bike hanging up these posters, and he would hang them up, and by the time he got back, he would notice a lot of them were taken down already. So people were already sort of into the art back then. So,
there are a lot of artists in the film, one of them being one of the, I guess, the founders of what we think of as rock poster art, Stanley Mouse. Tell us about Stanley Mouse and what he's most famous for.
Stanley did a poster with his art partner, Alton Kelly. They did a poster for the Grateful Dead with this skeleton and roses image. And there's actually a story in the film of where they how they came up with that image. But the Grateful Dead ended up using that image for their logo. So Stanley's very well known for that. Stanley's from Detroit, and he was really into the car culture, and he kind of had a following before he came to San Francisco. But
he's a pretty quiet guy.
He is. He's a very sweet guy.
Hence the name Mouse. It's a nickname, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Paul, why have you decided to stay involved with the local music scene? I'm sure you could get bigger paying gigs with bigger bands.
I don't listen to the bigger bands. I listen to punk rock, and I only want to do posters for shows that I want to go to. And I can't stand the giant shows where you see, you know, an ant-sized guy playing a guitar. You know, I'd rather go to a club or bar and where you can talk to the musicians and hang out with them and be part of the whole scene and everything that's going on, as opposed to being like some guy that just paid $40 for a ticket and sitting out in the crowd, you know, anonymously. So
$80 a ticket.
Yeah. Now I don't
$120 even know. $120
a ticket. So. Merle, do you still work in TV?
I do freelance, some freelance work.
Yeah. Have you gone back to MTV since you left?
I probably will at some point. I haven't since I started the project. But once I really run out of money, which is coming up, I'll be back.
Merle has joined the DIY
artist. I'm on the one meal a day plan. Yeah.
So making a movie about the rock poster scene is not, at least at this point, a lucrative business.
No. And it's not really hopefully someday I intend to recoup the costs that took to make it, but it wasn't really why I did it. I thought it was a story that should be told, and it's very tied to American history too, the culture of cultural changes that were going on in America. You can kind of see them reflected through the poster art, and I felt like nobody had really done a good job of outlining that and documenting it, so that's why I did it.
In the course of making the film, which took you several years, what did you learn about rock poster art and the artists that Or what surprised you about them?
One thing that surprised me were the personalities. There are definitely similarities in the personalities through the generations. Like when I would think of the 60s artists, I wouldn't think that they were as smart as, wise.
Okay.
Sorry. They're just characters. And I don't know. I think it's a common theme of rebellion and independent spirit. And it's throughout. So I think that was striking to me. I mean, I learned a lot. It's every project you do is a learning experience.
And Paul was smiling and laughing a little when you were talking about the personality of rock poster artists.
We're all a little nuts. I think it's breathing in the fumes from the inks and the screen printing chemicals.
And yet, despite this rebellious streak in the rock poster scene, to what extent do these people see themselves as artists? And to what extent does the art establishment see them as artists, Paul?
We're kind of left out of the art establishments. I mean, we're kind of inching our way in with the release of The Art of Modern Rock and some other books and this film. And so we're inching our way into credibility. But as far as feeling about being artists, I completely feel like I'm an artist. You know, I'm starving and I'm broke. So I kind of am in there. But it's weird right now. Since it is becoming a little more popular, a lot of kids are like getting out of design school and wanting to do rock posters to pad their portfolio. So they want to do a poster, and they all want to do a poster for the biggest band they can find. You know, how do I get to do a poster for the biggest band ever? You know, and they have no real idea of the music scene and what's involved with it. They just want to do something to be famous. And so it's a little weird right now because everyone's trying to jump on the bandwagon. So and then there's all these starving like artists that have been doing it for a long time without any support. And when I first started, I thought I was the only one, you know, doing what I do. I knew of a few other working artists, Firehouse and Derek Hess and, just a handful of other artists. And then when I used to do shows with 60s artists, mostly for the Rock Poster Society, and I wasn't really involved with the artists that are doing it today until the Flatstock poster show, the first Flatstock poster show in San Francisco, where there's a lot of artists that are doing the exact same thing from all over the world, and it was amazing. We were all shocked that we all did the same thing.
Well, for more about the rock poster scene in America, the film is American Artifact. It shows tonight at the Crest Theater in downtown Sacramento. The producer and director is Merle Becker. One of the artists featured is Paul Imagine of Sacramento. Paul, Merle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Kelly Minnemeyer and Lynn Weaver. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. And thank you for joining us. Deadline for the legislature passing California state budget has come and gone again. On the next Inside, Capitol Bureau Chief Marianne Rust tells what's happening with the never-ending budget process. And Sacramento's Mumbo Gumbo has a new album out, and they perform this weekend at Concerts in the Park. We'll talk with the band and hear some of the songs. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight
tomorrow morning at 10 on Capitol Public Radio.